We are delighted to be here. We have a live audience, and thank you, everybody, for being here. It wasn't hard to come here, was it, though, the first thing in the morning? It's a great place to be. We have two wonderful hours. Lori Winters will be joining us momentarily. Nancy Pearl, our wonderful librarian we claim as our own here in Milwaukee, will be joining us the second hour of the program. As I got up this morning, I was thinking that there are two places in this whole state of Wisconsin that I think are my favorite places. And one is this little place in Cable, Wisconsin. And I don't know how you get there exactly. It's in a little area that's got beautiful wildflowers and crystal clear streams and this very interesting foliage. And I go there whenever I'm near Cable. But topping Cable is the Milwaukee Art Museum. And I do believe that this is an absolute treasure, actually for the country, but particularly for the state of Wisconsin. It is so gorgeous. You can just come here, and I have many times, and stand in the building, and you feel like you're a work of art, right? You feel like you just stand there and people could come by and look at the building and look at you. It's just beautiful. And one of the things that we'll be happy to talk about with Lori is that, hard to believe, but it is the 10th anniversary of the Calatrava next year. And they are going to have a whole celebration of architecture, including Calatrava and Frank Lloyd Wright. They're bringing a wonderful exhibit from China here. So Lori will talk about all of that. Lori is spectacular. I have always thought, and I guess I'll say it publicly, although I would never want her to leave here, but she is just a top-notch person at what she does, and I keep thinking that one of these days she'll be the director of the Metropolitan. I really do. She's that good. She's director of exhibitions and publications for the Milwaukee Art Museum, and she's brought some extraordinary exhibits. She has a keen vision of what will be beautiful to look at, and it's quite a bit of work to bring some of these exhibitions here. Many of you have seen Out of Rembrandt's Shadow, Jan Leven's A Dutch Master Rediscovered. I love that exhibit. And the One Work Masterpiece, which ended just recently on Raphael, the woman with the veil. She brings exhibits here. She has done just so much. She's created all kinds of international partnerships with the Louvre and with the Albertini in Tina in Vienna. She is working with U.S. and Central European museums to collaborate on international exhibitions and to address the future of museums in the 21st century. She has been in classes for curatorial leadership, preparing top curators for positions, see, this is where I get this, as museum directors. And she has traveled all over the world and has wonderful stories to tell, not only about the exhibit she's bringing here, but what's in this art museum. And she'll share her vast knowledge and love for what she does. So please welcome Lori Winters, our first guest this hour. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning. Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah.
So that's quite an introduction, but thank you very much.
I think it's true. I predicted that Rachel Maddow would have a show of her own. And so, you see, we have a track record right here. Let's start with the Calatrava, because I get a little gushy about this place, but it is an extraordinary place. And I love the fact that you're going to have a celebration of architecture next year of Calatrava and Frank Lloyd Wright and others.
Yeah, thank you. I get a little gushy about it, too. I feel very fortunate to have been here from the very beginning. I started my position at the Milwaukee Art Museum in 1997. It's a long time ago. And I was part and participant and witness to the whole process of building this Calatrava edition, the Quadracci Pavilion. And it was quite a thing. I mean, it started with, it sounds like a cliche, but it really started with a dream and the hope of everyone involved in that project, from the staff to the trustees to the directors to the community. And the community at large felt that we needed to expand the museum as a kind of center, to create a kind of cultural community center, and to also take the museum from what was then a very, very good regional museum to a national and international museum. So I feel fortunate to have been here during that process, to have been part of the construction, to have witnessed that. And I think those dreams, those hopes, those aspirations have really been fulfilled over the last 10 years. So I'm very proud and privileged to be part of the Milwaukee Art Museum and what it means to the community. And we're constantly reassessing what that means. And I think we've done a pretty good job, but I think we in the future can do an even better job. So I look forward to that. I look forward to even a more active community participation and more international collaborations on exhibitions. And we always, you know, welcome the public feedback. So be interested to hear those.
You'll get some. I would hope that many of you will want to talk about the Calatrava. How do you celebrate the 10th anniversary?
With a lot of fanfare.
All right.
We've been planning the anniversary for, probably 2 years now. And that celebration means a lot of different things. It's been 10 years with the Calatrava edition. So one of the aspects of the building is the exhibition program. We have the Baker Rowland Galleries, which are dedicated to the exhibitions, the large-scale exhibitions that we do. We try to make those exhibitions of national and international significance. I think we do a pretty good job in delivering on that, and we're always aspiring to do better. So in an anniversary year, what better way than to plan an extraordinary schedule of exhibitions? So in February of 2011, we're going to open an exhibition on Frank Lloyd Wright. And there have been that's good. We always like to hear a few oohs and ahs. Frank Lloyd Wright, he is a commodity. He's sort of well-known. There have been a ton of exhibitions. So the question is, how do you come up with something different? And I know Kathleen is always interested in the behind the scenes and, how do we decide what we do? And, for us, as we approached the anniversary year, we felt that it was important to make a statement about architecture. We're working and living in one of the, the great buildings of the 21st century. So what better way to celebrate that anniversary than through an exhibition of architecture? I guess the natural thing to do might have been to, or the most obvious thing would have been to do an exhibition on Calatrava. And yes, we will do that, but later in the year. But we're going to start the anniversary year with Frank Lloyd Wright, looking at his organic architecture and defining what that means for Frank Lloyd Wright in the early 20th century. So we actually thought about taking another Frank Lloyd Wright exhibition. This is sort of the background. The Guggenheim, you may remember, in New York also celebrated their anniversary recently, and a Frank Lloyd Wright structure. And we liked that exhibition, but I saw it. I saw it with a couple of my colleagues. And we decided that it wasn't right for us. It was a great exhibition. They encouraged us to take the exhibition. And we just decided that it didn't focus on the things that we wanted to focus on or the things that we needed it to focus on. For example, 2011 is the 100th anniversary of Taliesin East. Mm. So we felt it was important to put an emphasis on that and also Taliesin West. In Spring Green, it's, Taliesin East is the home and the studio of Frank Lloyd Wright. So to have an exhibition that doesn't pay attention to that in Wisconsin, we thought we'd be missing the opportunity. So we decided, and our chief curator, Brady Roberts, is organizing this exhibition in collaboration with the Phoenix Art Museum and the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation in Scottsdale, Arizona. And it's going to be spectacular. Over 30% of the works in the show, these are the plans, the drawings by Frank Lloyd Wright and his studio, have never been seen by the public before.
Oh, my goodness.
So sometimes bringing it home makes a better show.
Right, exactly. And do you see is there any Frank Lloyd Wright, I guess I want to know what Calatrava, and maybe you don't know this, thought of Frank Lloyd Wright. Is there any of his, using light, et cetera, that's in this building?
Great connection between Calatrava and Frank Lloyd Wright, and that's part of the reason to focus on Frank Lloyd Wright. Calatrava, in designing the building, came here 42 times. He was 42 years old. This is, he's just at the peak of his career in 2000, 2001 when he's designing this building. And he wanted the building to respond to the environment. And that's something that Frank Lloyd Wright was attuned to. So Calatrava went to Madison. He went to Monona. He went to Taliesin East. And he was greatly influenced by the Johnson Wax Factory in Racine. And you can see that in the organic elements in the architecture of our building. In the underground parking lot, you can see the shape of the windows. It comes from Calatrava. And the whole idea of connecting with the landscape and the environment is something that Calatrava just picked up. You know, it was sort of that genius in Calatrava that he was able to make that connection with environment. And he responded to this site. It wasn't just a building that was plopped down. I mean, he stood out on the lakefront and thought, this is a spectacular view. This is one of the best views in the world. So he put glass everywhere so you could enjoy that view. He also realized that in designing the building that it is a spectacular view, and it's a spectacular view from the downtown, so let's not block that. So he created a kind of building that hugs low to the ground so that it wouldn't obstruct the great view from the downtown. And, you know, being European, I like to say that he has a certain kind of affinity for symmetry. And so he created this sort of central axis with Wisconsin Avenue and the bridge, for which he's famous for his bridge designs, and use that bridge to connect to the downtown. So even Calatrava was thinking way back in 1997, how do you connect the museum to the heart of the city? And, you know, that's what we as the staff who work here try to fulfill every day. How do we connect the museum to the city?
He certainly succeeded. It is a gorgeous place, isn't it? It's just gorgeous. You're also bringing a major exhibition from China.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about that. Not just one exhibition, but four exhibitions of Chinese art. And you might think, well, you know, a lot of museums in the world do exhibitions of Chinese art. You know, why is that important? Well, it's important for us because it's our first exhibition, four exhibitions simultaneously, of Chinese art ever in this museum. And, you know, when we were, you know, thinking about what the new building would give us the opportunity in 2000 and 2001, you know, one of the things that I focused on with an interest in exhibitions was, you know, how do we become more international? And in the following 10 years, we've been able to do exhibitions in Europe with some of the great museums, like the Louvre in Paris, the Albertina in Vienna, the Deutsches Historisches Museum in Berlin, the Tate in London. These have been great partnerships. We spend a lot of time cultivating our relationships with important museums, both here in the States and in Europe. But we've never gone to Asia. We've never worked with Asian museums. So I think this makes us a more global museum. And let's face it, you know, we're even probably a little late coming to the table in terms of the global world. We're doing this exhibition with the palace in Beijing, the Forbidden City, and a lot of the works that will be, in fact, all of the works that are coming in this exhibition will be seen for the very first time in the U.S. And in fact, because many of them have been conserved specifically for this exhibition by the World Monuments Fund in New York, they're going to be seen in the U.S. before they're even seen by the public in China. So an amazing thing. So it's going to be 18th century Chinese imperial objects on view in this museum for the first time. And then we can talk more about the other exhibitions if you like.
But we will.
This is a big deal. The mayor has declared 2011 the Summer of China in Milwaukee.
Oh, my. Won't that be exciting? The other thing that we tend to forget, because we just forget things, we're on to the next thing immediately, but it hasn't been that long that China has been open to us. So when you think about it, in our lifetimes, you've been able to secure this major exhibition, whereas 50 years ago, you couldn't go into the country.
Right. And as we've started, you know, Wisconsin actually plays a very important role of China. And it's something that I've learned in beginning to prepare for this exhibition, organizing this exhibition. We actually have more Fortune 500 companies doing business in China than any other state in the union. So we're already, you know, a global economy. And now I think we're starting to reflect that more global economy through our appreciation of culture. So it's a very exciting time, I think, not only just for the museum, but for Wisconsin in general. And we have a number of Wisconsin corporate entities that have come forward to sponsor this exhibition, and in some cases, sponsors that we've never worked with before. So we're pretty excited about that.
Lori Winters is our guest the first hour. We're broadcasting live from the beautiful, as she called it, one of the, I like this description, great buildings of the 21st century, the Calatrava here in downtown Milwaukee. We have a live audience. They're all dressed for the occasion. A lot of artistic outfits in the audience. And Lori is, as you can tell from listening to her, if you haven't met her before, she's really a visionary. She's brought some truly beautiful exhibits and hard-to-get exhibits to this museum. And she has one of those eyes that I wish I had to figure out how it's going to mean the most to the people who see it. She just knows how to do that. And she's bringing, as you heard, some wonderful exhibits, and there are some here as well. We're going to go to our studio audience. As long as you're here, we are going to give preference to those of you who were kind enough to come and join us here at the Art Museum today. As Lisa told you, the microphones are on both sides here. If you have questions about upcoming exhibits, about the Calatrava exhibits that you've seen, Lori's work, of how do you decide, and I want to ask her this, of all that there is in the world, what do you want to bring here? And then how do you make that happen? I think that's always interesting. How does it get here? Kind of insurance? What do they put? How do they wrap things? We worry about making sure things get safely to somewhere in the country. What about a great work of art that's worth millions? How do you get it here? All right, so grab a microphone. We'll take your questions in just a moment. We also will welcome on-air phone calls. If you can't be with us today, our number is 800-486-8655, 1-800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Milwaukee Art Museum today with a live audience. The second hour of our program, Nancy Pearl will be joining us, the only librarian with her own action figure. I keep this on my desk at work. Is Nancy in the house? Where is she? Hey, Nancy. Hey, there's Nancy. Okay, good to see you. Yeah. Nancy will be with us, our number two. She's been with us many, many times. Her latest book is Booklust to Go, but we'll talk to her about all kinds of literature. You know who she is and treasure her as much as we do. I've had three people say to me this hour, I wish Nancy would move to Milwaukee and she would do a show once a week. Aha! Yeah. We'll try to get her here more often. Okay, we go to our audience. Hi.
Hi, my name is Melissa, and I'm here from Libertyville, Illinois.
Oh!
And first a comment. I just want to make a plug for membership in the museum. I'm a member of the museum, and it's the greatest deal in town. It gets me in free here, but it's also gotten me in at no charge at the Frick, the Gardner, the Museum of Contemporary Art, and one other one I can't remember. So membership's a great bargain. And in fact, it got me in to see the 8 four times, and it got me in to see the Raphael and the Levin show a couple of times. And what I'm interested in, what I love about your exhibits, is how they combine things that I wouldn't have necessarily put together and make me see, allow me to see connections between different art and different artists. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, how you go about looking for bringing other artists into the main show, bringing the other artists that you brought into the Raphael, into the Levin show. Of course, Rembrandt was there, but there were others. And the 8, of course, was an embarrassment of riches. So I appreciate what you do.
Great question.
Okay, thank you. If you would give your resume to our marketing director who's sitting over here. I swear that was not a plant. Thank you. That's great. Thank you for noticing the connections. We work very hard to figure out how not just to present the art, but how to make the connective tissue between a single artist and a larger period and context, sort of obvious for the audience. And so I appreciate you commenting on that. We, employ a lot of different materials to make that happen, from descriptive labels and text panels and didactic materials to video installations and digital technology and audio tours to help explain sort of the context. So for me, I mean, I actually come from a history background. As an undergraduate, I majored in history. And so for me, it's very important to understand why things from any given period, even from our own period, are important, so we do try to expand that. And I know all of our curators work very hard, and our education department works very hard to put it into a context Otherwise,
and you do that well. You always have lectures when there's an exhibit. You have publications. So you do feel, I never thought of that, but you do feel as though you're learning the history of the time of the artist as well, which is nice. So if all there is in the world, and heavens knows there's a lot of art in the world, how do you discern what is the best, what needs to be brought to Milwaukee, how you will get it here, how do you negotiate with somebody to let their work of art leave a country? That's a big job. How do you decide over a year what's going to come here?
Well, there are a couple of questions embedded in that larger question. So let me just start with the decision-making process. I would say in any given year, we have proposals from our curatorial staff. And we really have a top-notch curatorial department to do exhibitions. And we try to give those, you know, priority because we feel that it's important for our curators to be making connections, to use our collections, to draw on their relationships nationally and internationally to put forward exhibitions. We do have proposals from the outside that come to us from other museums, sometimes even from organizations, independent organizations that organize exhibitions and then travel them. I would say in any given year we have about 100 outside proposals that we look at seriously, and we vet those as a team, first with the curatorial department and through with our chief curator involved in that process, and then also with our director in that process. And then we have an exhibition committee of subcommittee of the Board of Trustees, and they're also involved in the vetting process. For the most part, I mean, and we do that, so it sounds sort of complicated, but we do that because we feel it's important to have a broader conversation. It would be one thing if we were, you know, just doing art for our internal audience, for our own staff, but we realize what we do is for the larger community and then also for the scholarly community. So we really try to find a balance in terms of contribution to scholarship in the field and then impact in the community. And connected with that is also the context of, you know, what do we choose? We do have strengths in our museum in American art and contemporary art. So we look at those as well, and we try to build on those areas of strength as much as we possibly can. Also, the European area, I think, is quite strong. So in any given year, we try to have one important European exhibition, something that's significant in the contemporary area, also something important in the American art, American decorative arts area. So for us, it's a little bit of a juggling act to try and balance that schedule and to be able to offer something to our community. We also have a large audience that enjoys photography, so we do try to offer a very active photography program. So it's the caliber of the work, whether it's the caliber of the exhibition proposal, whether it's from our staff or from an outside museum or agency, balanced with our larger schedule and program.
I'm glad the Libertyville person brought up the Leavens exhibit. How many saw the Leavens exhibit? Many of you did. It was so gorgeous, wasn't it? It was just beautiful. It was beautiful. And you can bring it to mind again right now. And for me, I wonder if this happens to you, you sort of miss it. Do you miss it? It's gone, and it probably won't be back again. And I know you've got it with you, but I wish it were coming back.
I guess with an exhibition, you learn something with every new project about the art and about the art of doing an exhibition and about the relationships that you've established with that exhibition. So it's a kind of cumulative growth and education process with every exhibition. And, you know, we hope that that experience learned with one makes us better with the next round.
Yeah. Did you like putting that together, though? That was a beauty, don't you
think?
Well,
that was a great exhibition because we partnered with the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. And if you've ever been to the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., I mean, it's an awe-inspiring place with magnificent collections and a great staff. So to be able to partner with them in that exhibition was a great opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Another question from our wonderful audience.
Yes, Connie Hawkins from Brookfield, Wisconsin. I just wanted to make another comment about the Calatrava, how it matches up exactly with the DeSuvio orange sculpture, and it just thrills me every time if I come down Wisconsin Avenue and see how perfectly it's in a line with that sculpture.
Yeah, I think you may be one of the few people to notice that, actually. You know, Calatrava did design the entrance to the Calatrava building and the bridge to align perfectly with Wisconsin Avenue. So when if you have the opportunity, go stand in the middle of Wisconsin Avenue when there isn't a lot of traffic, and it does line up perfectly. And then there is the intermediary element of the DeSouvre, which is also aligned with Wisconsin Avenue. So it is a spectacular entrance. And that's something that Calatrava really gave a lot of thought to. For those of you who knew the museum in its previous iteration, the entrance to the museum was not obvious. That's a problem when you're trying to get people to come to your building. And Calatrava addressed that in a number of different ways and solved the solution, and you know, came up with a solution that was perfect for our venue.
Yeah. We've got a smart audience. Look at that. You knew right away how it was lined up, and now we'll all look at it in a different way, too, which is great. Are there certain places, I've told you many times before, but I would love to be able to come to this building to work every day, as I'm sure that all of us would. Are there places that you go in this building at least once a week or once a day where you just love it so much and you're inspired by it?
That's a tough question. I was going to say my office, but...
I've never seen your office. I want to see your office.
Well, it's definitely not awe-inspiring. It's, you know, just covered with, you know, books and clutter. I do in my office, I just mentioned that I do have posters from exhibitions, from previous exhibitions hanging on my wall. And I do take some inspiration from that, you know, from what the museum has been able to accomplish in the past. And so it's nice to have that kind of reminder. You know, for me, I think one of the most awe-inspiring places in the museum is the Wendover Hall. It's the main entrance into the Calatrava building.
No doubt.
And I have to tell you, I feel pretty fortunate because I've been here at, you know, to do news reports and that kind of thing at 6 a.m. And when the sun is coming up over the lake and it's all pink and rosy and you have that pink reflected off of the white marble floor, it's breathtaking. Mm. I mean, it's one of the most spectacular things you would ever see. So maybe we should think about doing an event at 6 a.m. so we can actually watch
yes.
the sunrise. But it's
yes.
it's really quite an experience.
We'll be there, won't we? That sounds great to me. Yeah, all right. Coffee, sweet rolls, and that view? Oh, that would really do that. That would be just wonderful. I like that. Just a reminder that you're welcome to... Oh, we have somebody. Whenever you have a question, be it about current exhibits, which we have yet to talk about, or what's coming, or this building, or Lori's work, our microphones are right over here on the sides. Go right ahead.
My name is Nellery Forrest. I work here. and I recently graduated about a year ago, and I started volunteering here a year ago. And I'm a huge Lori Winters fan. Part of the reason why I came here. And one of the things that I wanted to do when I came here was join the docent program and give tours for kids and provide education and continue learning myself. One thing that I've learned is that Lori Winters did some spectacular and beautiful things within our permanent collection. And I was wondering what sort of ideas you have for keeping those, our permanent collection, alive and contemporary within art history itself?
Okay, good question. Thank you, Nell. You know, it is a question, and let me just broaden that out a little bit and then sort of hone in on it. In a place like New York or Washington, Los Angeles, there is a very large percentage of the visitors, extraordinarily large, who attend museums who are tourists. And the Metropolitan Museum, for example, I think I know their statistics, 85% of their visitors in a year, and it's huge, by the way, over 8 million people, visitors. So for them, the collections are, you know, always new and always fresh. So one of the challenges that we face as an institution in Milwaukee, where we'd like to have a greater visitorship, but it's not comparable to a large city like Washington or New York, we feel that we need to have a strong exhibition program, because we want to have the experience where people come back to the museum for different experiences and for different educational components in any given year. And one of the things that we spend a lot of time talking about is the permanent collection. How can we use the permanent collection, which is, by the way, outstanding, to provide a different experience for the audience every time they come back, whether they're from Brookfield or Mequon, the east side, south side, and they've been here 20 or 30 times before, or five times in any given year. I mean, how do you have a different experience for that audience each and every time? So that's one of the things we're talking more and more about, what kind of technology we can use to do that, also the kinds of installations. And one of the things that I find very interesting is a kind of, for lack of a better word, let's just call it an intervention, where we use an artwork and use it as a kind of intervention in an already set and predictable space or gallery. And we might use contemporary art to do that, as a contemporary artist reacts to, let's say, a space in the museum. So that's one of the things that we're thinking more about doing in the future, and finding ways that make the permanent collection always fresh and new. And I wanted to just share with you also that our permanent collection may be a kind of a well-kept secret. When we have visiting directors, curators from around the world, and we've had some pretty major directors here, including the director of the Louvre and the Albertina, they're always surprised. Milwaukee's a kind of well-kept secret. That's not necessarily a good thing. So we're working very hard now that we've had our 10-year, we're about to approach our 10-year anniversary, to take the surprise element out of those kinds of conversations. So for us, we really want to get the word out about what a great museum we have. And, you know, just in, you know, there are always these rankings and various metrics based on size and caliber of your education program and caliber of your collections. Well, there are a lot of museums in the United States. We're ranked 16th.
Wow, yeah. That's great.
Most people don't realize that, and that is a phenomenal thing. And this is a community museum. This is not a private museum. This is a public institution. So that's really a compliment that you can pay to yourselves. You build this museum and expand it through your gifts and donations, your dollars, and, yes, even your memberships. Mm. You make all this possible.
Well, let's just go back to that permanent collection for a moment. Because it seems to me as though, I wonder if it's sort of like baseball, that the teams like New York have much bigger bundles of money that they can give to their players, and so they go to the World Series way too often. But so is it true of museums as well, that if you are in New York or if you're in Washington or one of those cities that has more people go to the museum, more money, et cetera, that they have a better chance to get some of the permanent collections that you want in Milwaukee? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a good question. We're smaller, but I don't necessarily think that that's a disadvantage. Mm. I think it makes us a little bit more flexible, a little bit more nimble. Quite honestly, Milwaukee's a very friendly place. It was one of the reasons my husband and I moved here. From the East Coast, and the museum is friendly as a consequence, and people are friendly. And for me, when I think about museum relationships, whether it's exhibitions or working with private collectors or donors, I mean, it really is all about building relationships. And I think we do a pretty good job of that, and increasingly we're getting more and more attention from private collectors who live in Chicago who are favoring us over the Art Institute. Hard to believe, but yes, it's true. And again, that's just something as a community and as an organization, as an institution, we should pat ourselves on the back for.
Yeah, by all means. From the audience.
Thank you, Kathleen, for having this program today. It's wonderful.
Our pleasure.
My name is Marcy Holman. I'm from Lake Geneva. And my husband and I come here quite often, and we so enjoy the quilts of G's Bend, and I also love all the educational opportunities when you do have your exhibits with the headsets that we can listen to and the books that you can purchase afterwards at the wonderful gift store that the museum has. So thank you for that. I have two questions. When you're putting an exhibit together, and how do you find out people that own different pieces of artwork in a private collection to secure them for the show? And also, do you ever look at a piece of artwork and wonder why they chose that particular frame? If you're ever thinking, yikes, yikes, why did they do that? Or is it like, oh, that was a good idea? Those were some of the questions that I had. And one other one, I can't think of the artist's name. It's a male artist from Wisconsin. And it was beautiful, beautiful outdoor work, his paintings. One of them covered like a whole wall. It was like flying birds. You were standing in the woods. It was just extraordinary. And I hope he is able to have another showing at the museum.
Right.
Thank you.
That's Tom Utek. So let's put in a plug for our Wisconsin artist. That's Tom Utek. He's a great artist. He has a New York gallery. He's true to the nature of the landscape of Wisconsin, and his works are very beautiful. Mm-hmm. So, let me answer the frames first. I often look at the frames, and sometimes I even am a little embarrassed because sometimes when I go into an exhibition, I'll look more at the choice of wall color in the frames than the actual artwork. Mm-hmm. So I have to really focus on not doing that. Mm-hmm. But those can be big mistakes that a museum makes, but also I think private collectors. Okay, frames. It's always best if you can have a period frame. So what does that mean? That means it was original to the artwork, so if it's an 18th century painting, it has an 18th century frame. And fortunately, in our museum, we do have a lot of period frames. We have a few that are from a later generation. So you might ask the question, why do I change a period frame? It's really only in the 20th century that we've started to recognize the aesthetic value of looking at a painting in its original frame. In some cases, those frames were chosen by the artist or even carved and sculpted, gilded by the artist. Mm-hmm. So they actually are an important artwork, part of the artwork. And we do try to make that distinction. For example, you may not know this, but the Impressionists were very specific about the type of frame that they wanted mm-hmm. surrounding their works. It's a very important element. And so why do you take a period frame off? I think in later periods, let's say the 19th and early 20th century, individual owners would sometimes change a frame to fit home decor. And then what happened all too often, unfortunately, was sometimes an owner would buy a painting, for example, and had a great frame, but they didn't fit each other. So the owner would have the painting cut down to fit the frame.
Oh, my.
So actually, one of the conservation issues that we deal with in the museum world is actually looking at paintings that have been cut down at a later time to fit frame. Sometimes we restore those when we can and when we know how to their original size, because we feel it's appropriate to be authentic in the presentation of the artwork. And sometimes you just simply can't because you don't know what was there before.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. We're going to take more phone calls. We're broadcasting live today from the Milwaukee Art Museum. We've been looking forward to this for a long time. Two of our favorite women are with us, Lori Winters, who is the director of exhibits here at the museum and has done just a wonderful job. I hope you realize what you realize. This audience is here, but you know what she's done for this museum. Nancy Pearl is going to join us the second hour of the program. Nancy is here in Milwaukee from Seattle, and she'll be here to talk about books, of course. And we're welcoming more of your questions and comments from the audience. Those are the microphones for you to join us on air. Or if you'd like to call, you can do that And that number is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Milwaukee Art Museum. Lori Winters is our guest the first hour of the program, and we're welcoming your comments from the audience as well. We have an interesting email, Lori, and it's this. Could you ask if it would be detrimental to the aesthetic enjoyment of the new building if the county were to sell the area? We all know there was a horrible accident in the parking lot here. The structure is closed. It may be torn down. There may be plans for commercial development of a prestige office or a residential building. What would you like to have there?
Well, okay, first of all, it's not up to me.
Well, if it were. If it were.
You know, I have complete confidence. I mean, there are a number of options on the table, and you know, I'm sure that you've read those in the newspaper. You've heard about them on the television. There are a lot of great ideas out there, and there are some, you know, very smart, capable people who are working on this and will make a decision. And I'm sure, whatever the final result is, that it will be a good choice. I mean, the building that you're, you know, the College Travel building, choosing the architect was a committee decision, and look how spectacularly that turned out.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe the architect should come back and figure out what to do with that space. I trust him. You trust him?
Yeah, well, we do plan to have Calatrava back for our big gala celebration, which will happen in September 2011. As you remember, we opened the Calatrava building in two stages in 2011, in May and then in October. And we've planned a big opening kind of public celebration and then gala for our 10th anniversary. And then I should just mention, too, that the 10th anniversary in 2011 is just the beginning, because in 2013 we're going to celebrate our 125th anniversary of the museum.
Ooh!
So it's a twofer, really. Beginning in 2011, and then 2013 as our institutional anniversary. So we're very excited. We're already planning for that anniversary celebration too.
We should talk about what exhibits you have right now too. For those who are here who would like to go to the museum today, what's here? You have a miniature exhibit.
We do have a smaller exhibition animating our permanent collection galleries. It's an exhibition of portrait miniatures focusing on love and loss. Portrait miniatures, exactly what it sounds, portraits in miniature scale. Typically, they're about 2.5 to 3 inches tall, and they were done for kind of intimate personal possession. Essentially, they were an early version of photographs of your beloved. And we have a curator, Catherine Suwinski, who's done a fabulous job researching our collection. And our collection as a group is on view for the very first time in the history of the museum of portrait miniatures. And then we also had a number of loans from private collectors and museums throughout the state. So it's really a top-notch and interesting exhibition. Then in our large exhibition space, our Baker Rowland Galleries, we have an exhibition called European Design Since 1985. And what is that? That is an extraordinary group of more than 200 objects, domestic objects and kind of artistic conceptual objects that meant for the home by top designers from all from Europe, including Alberto Alessi and Philippe Starck, you know, sort of great names. And, you know, what are the objects? So it's chairs and sofas and lamps and kitchen utensils. And some of them are beautiful. You can buy them even in our store or at Target. And then some of them are top end, worth millions of dollars that I certainly can't afford, but are, you know, in themselves high end art objects. So this is a very different exhibition for us. This is our very first exhibition focusing on 20th and 21st century design. And I'm excited about it. I think it looks great in our space. And it's also, I think it reflects sort of a change in culture, too. I mean, we used to think of fine art as just, you know, painting and sculpture and earlier decorative arts, American furniture from the 18th century. But now, fine arts also includes design, contemporary design. And it's interesting because, you know, how you choose to surround yourself in your home, what you put yourself, what kind of space you create for yourself says a lot about you. It says a lot about your response to the cultural environment and so forth. So I haven't told my husband this, but I think I'm a closet minimalist. And by that, I mean there are a lot of works in the show that are very minimal and conceptual in design, very sparse, and just very, very beautiful. And if I had to design my living space again, I would probably focus on the minimalist and sort of geometric kinds
of
designs.
We'll do it with just one room.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Can be your room.
Yeah.
She can have a room of her own. The other thing that's interesting, and it's the history involved in this, is that it's European because of the fall of the Soviet Union and because of the fall of the Berlin Wall, that you had this huge market in Europe, right? So a lot of the design came because people were buying things in Europe, which is an interesting history.
It is an interesting history, and with the creation of the EU, the kind of cross-cultural boundaries that we normally thought of from the 70s and 80s, those boundaries, those walls have come down. And so European design has really become international. And I would even include the U.S. in that. This focuses on European designers, but also the U.S. designers. I mean, their works are sold here in the States in stores and in galleries and online and in stores like Target and Walmart even. So it has become a global world in terms of contemporary design.
Yeah. Do we have a caller? Okay, let's do that. You'll need your earphones, I think.
Okay.
You'll need your earphones. All right, let's take a caller. I think it's Steve from McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Steve. Hi, Steve. Go right ahead. Well, Steve is just not there. I'm very sorry, Steve. That's we tried. If anybody in the audience wants to grab a microphone, please do that. We would like very much to have you come to the microphone in our studio audience particularly and join with your questions. The other thing I wonder is, people I think are fascinated by how things get here and how obviously you talk about some of the things you could buy at Target, some of the things you can't buy anywhere because they're so incredibly precious. And you've told me stories before of what it takes, Lori, to bring some of these gorgeous, very expensive, very rare works of art. How will you do it, say, with China in the exhibit that's coming out? Do you ship it? Do you fly it? How much do you insure it? How do you pack it?
Okay, a lot of questions. Yes.
Yeah.
And the answer is it's very complicated, and it really takes an army of people to make it happen. And fortunately, we have a fantastic staff from our registrars to our art handlers and designers. In the very early process, we begin to of an exhibition. We're working on loans and agreements, and that happens a lot by relationships and relationship building and just making connections. One connection leads to another. And then once we make the decision that we do want a particular work of art in an exhibition or here at the museum in general, we do have a loan agreement policy. It's essentially a contract with each lender that we sign. And that determines the value of the work and how it will be shipped and under what circumstances and whether there's a courier to accompany the work, whether the courier needs to see the installation, how it will be crated. Wow. Then we use outside firms to pack and crate and ship the work, and our registrars handle all of that sort of negotiation on when things are actually in a truck and on their way. And even something like that is interesting with fine art shipments. You know, those are trucks that are, they're always unmarked trucks, so you never know, but they're always followed by satellite. So, as those big semi-trucks filled with, millions of dollars of painting are going down the highway, unbeknownst to the average person driving next to them, they're followed by satellite, and they can't stop per requirement. The truck drivers can't stop per requirement because that puts the work at risk. So quite often you need more than one driver in a cab because they'll drive across the country nonstop to the next museum. And then we have a great crew of art handlers here who are very professional about handling the art, making sure it gets on the wall safely, conservators to inspect the works of art. So it's like an army sort of takes over with an exhibition, and I'm very proud of our team.
Yeah, that's fascinating. From our audience, hi.
Hi, I'm Cindy from Delafield, and I just it's more of a comment slash compliment that I want to voice. I'm a retired teacher, and our school usually would bring one of our classes, our grade levels here. And one year when I was teaching second grade, I collaborated, or our second grade collaborated with our art teacher, trying to show the connections between science and art. And we brought about 98-year-olds to see the Chihuly glass exhibit. Mm-hmm. And they were so respectful because of our prior education, our wonderful art teacher, Cindy, also, prior education. The compliment is that they all went home and wanted their parents to bring them back. And so many of the parents came to school and just were so charged that their 7 and 8-year-olds already were interested in this art museum and wondering what the next exhibits were. And one of my students went home and tried to create the Calatrava in diorama form.
Oh, that's great. And on that note, we thank you very much. We have news coming up. And, Lori, thank you so much for being with us. You're just
thank
the best.
You.
Thank you. Lori Winters, Director of Exhibitions. We'll return with Nancy Pearl.